Are you looking to sharpen your command and leadership skills? The 2024 Blue Card Hazard Zone Conference is coming back to the Sharonville Convention Center in Cincinnati, Ohio, September 30th through October 4th. Immerse yourself in 5 days of targeted command education and leadership training at the 2024 Blue Card Hazard Zone Conference. This is your opportunity to recharge your command skills and stay at the forefront of incident command best practices. This year, we've added a certification lab, September 30th through October 2nd. Also added a May Day workshop, October 1st to October 2nd. The general conference is on October 3rd and 4th. The May Day workshop is filling up fast, and our early bird pricing of $415 each for the general conference is a limited time offer. Don't miss out on this opportunity. Register now at HazardZoneBC.com.
Hello, John Vance here from B-Shifter. Thank you for joining us today for a very special B-Shifter podcast. Today's date is March 14th, 2024, and today commemorates the 23rd anniversary of the Southwest Supermarket fire in Phoenix, Arizona. While this incident resulted in the death of firefighter Brett Tarver, it's important to note 13 total Maydays were transmitted and deep scars for many working in the Phoenix Fire Department. It also resulted in a transformative change to the American Fire Service. Through unparalleled leadership and vision, a five-year examination of what actually occurred took place. The focus of the examination, most importantly, covered why it occurred. As a result, Fire Chief Alan Brunicini recognized critical changes needed to be made on all levels on the fire ground. A diligent team worked to uncover, refine, and implement significant changes that ultimately led to what we know as the Blue Card Incident Command Certification System today. This certification system is designed to establish a standard, provide training, and give a mechanism to measure performance in the streets for over 4,000 fire departments across the world. The lessons learned have not been lost or forgotten, and we continue to apply them today. So first of all, we'll be joined here in the studio by Nick Brunicini, Terry Garrison, and Chris Stewart. They're going to talk about, as members of the fire department, that day and what occurred. Then we'll also go to clips of Chief Alan Brunicini, a recording that was made several years ago at the National Fire Academy. It was facilitated by Chief Dennis Rubin, who you'll hear talking about that. And Chief Brunicini will talk about the Tarver recovery process as well. We appreciate you joining us today. And let us never forget the sacrifices made by Brett Tarver, those on the scene, and as we continue to fix ourselves every day.
You know, I'll go ahead and jump off here because I just happened to be in an acting deputy chief position at the time. I had a staff job. They assigned me there to a staff job for a couple months. And in those days, the staff deputy chief would respond as a senior advisor to incidents. And so I responded to that call. And en route to that call, I heard the Mayday. So the Maydays had occurred prior to me arriving on the scene. And when I arrived on the scene, so my role was pretty much to support the incident commander and wait for the command van to show up. The command van had already just arrived, I think, prior to my arrival. And so I went over and I got in a command van. And when I walked into the command van, the John Hinton was already in the command van, and he was ready to kind of take the incident while the IC number two was in his Suburban. So that was kind of John's role as it, at the time. And I think, and I'll let other guys jump in because I don't want to monopolize the front end of this too much. But what had happened was for us, the Maydays were occurring. The building was extremely volatile. The smoke was coming across. It was a wind-driven fire. The command van and the first Suburban, which is the first IC vehicle, were parked where the smoke was headed. We were on the smoky side of the building, the actual windward side of the building. Is that correct? Windward, leeward? Sorry. I know that.
And you were leeward.
Yeah, we were the leeward. The wind was coming from the west, and we were on the east side. How about that? And so I walked in the command van. I saw John Hinton there, and he had his partner, who was his driver at the time. It's like, where's the IC? He's over in the Suburban. I've tried to get him over here a few times. I've told him to come on over. We're ready for him. And just because of the nature of the call and the way we operated back then, it was difficult to get Richard Wolf, the IC, over to the command van because he was incredibly busy. And, you know, I could understand that because we all would have that same problem back then, you know, moving from a Suburban to the command van. And so we physically had to go grab him by force and bring him to the command van and sit him in the command van. John Hinton took over the radio operation from there. He became the IC until Richard Wolf got in the command van. And then we kind of operated as a command team from that point on.
And this was before or after the Mayday?
This was after the Mayday. Okay. The Mayday is actually...
it was the initial Mayday, right?
Yeah, the initial Mayday actually occurred while I was en route to the incident. I was listening on the tactical channel, and I could hear the Mayday. I couldn't hear it very clearly as I was driving. I was making my way through traffic in a staff vehicle, doing the best I could, but I did hear the Mayday. So this was after the Mayday.
Yeah. I actually wasn't at the scene. I came in and I relieved. It was a C-shift fire. I was a B-shifter, and I came in and relieved Engine 6, Rudy Demas on Engine 6. And they had been the company that actually had them and Ladder 1 had their hands on Brett last. They were the ones that actually got him out of the building. So I don't have any personal experience actually at the scene, but I did speak to Ladder 1 that night. I got the download from Engine 6 that night and kind of the raw emotion really of that and, you know, what had happened and folks that I've known for a long time and worked with and who I knew to be really, really competent firefighters, you know, looking at you with the most serious eyes you can imagine saying that was the hardest thing we've ever done. It was unbelievably difficult to get him out of there. So that's kind of my connection to it. And then everything that went on in the recovery afterwards and my participation.
So, but none of it started that way. The call started off. It was kids walking home from school and there was a dumpster and some trash by it and they lit it on fire. So when the first crews got there, it was an outside fire is what they were fighting. So, and they were kind of taking it that way, but they had, you know, they had covered all their tactical positions. They put lines where they needed to, but it became very difficult to tell that the fire had actually extended into the building. So I think that kind of kept sucking them into the thing. So in the very beginning, they thought they had a fire that was more outside. And then even when like Rich got there and transferred command, is they had called for more help, and they were getting ready to cancel that because he thought he had fire control. I mean, that's what it was starting to look like. But the smoke wouldn't stop. So they thought that something's still going on. So you just couldn't get around the whole thing to figure out exactly what you had going on. And they had already come back with an all clear on the grocery store before there was ever a Mayday. I mean, some of the first crews, they went in to the grocery store and then the two occupancies that were built into the grocery store, got all clears on them, no fire, nothing in the attic in those two exposures. And then in the big store, they just had a little haze here and there. And so they cleared the store. There was nobody inside the grocery store anymore. And then they had called, they had balanced, got more help. And I want to say it was Engine 3 was staged in level one staging. And the captain on the truck watched the fire flash in the back of the grocery store and got on the radio and said, did you see, called Rich, did you see what just happened? Yeah, we're on it. So now it's like, okay, we know. And so now they start taking lines in places, and that's where it, Act Two is really what kind of sucker punched them in the thing.
Right. And, you know, about that is Rich had a really good plan, the way he was operating around that incident prior to the Mayday. Because like you said, the way the grocery store had been there for so many years, but they built those two structures on the, I think, the south the southeast side. And it looked like it was originally, it looked like it was part of the building. They did such a great job with the facade and making it match so well. So when Rich sent guys in there to check, he sent a crew in there and pulled ceiling, make sure it's not above us. They went in there, they pulled ceiling in those two occupancies. There was no fire, no smoke. Yeah, we're clear up here. Yeah, everything,
I think
it
was
should,
engine 21.
Yeah, everything should be pretty good. We're doing fine in here. So he's feeling pretty comfortable about everything. Little did he know that the fire was being wind-driven above the false ceiling or up in the plenum space in the grocery store the whole time that they're in there. And it grew to the point where there was no more space for it. The smoke starts banking down, you get the flash, and you got firefighters way back in the store.
There were chiefs in the back of the building. I think it was Gomez was back there, and he kept trying to get on the radio to tell him, you got smoke pouring out the scuppers on what was essentially the Charlie side of the building. You had no access to it. You had to walk. You couldn't drive. So he's on the back, and he knew. He said, it's in the attic, man. You got to – and at that point, you got a well-involved attic fire of a 25,000-square-foot grocery store. That set of critical factors equals defensive strategy. Right. Sooner than later. Now, you know, you're inside. You're going to finish what you're doing and get everybody out and do an orderly withdrawal, maybe not an abandon, but – that information couldn't get in because at the point they're all starting to figure it out at the same time and people are in like positions screaming for things now. And so Gomez says, I was locked out of the radio. I went to go talk to him, and that's about the time I think you guys came over and grabbed Rich and said, no, you got to come to the command van.
And Rich's plan was going defensive, and we got to remember that.
Well, he was defensive.
Yeah, well, he was going defensive, and then he hears Brett Tarver on the radio say, hey, don't leave me in here type conversation. I know Chris probably most recently spent the most time reading about this and really studying it, so he probably has some information about how that actually occurred right there.
From what I understand, they had already gone defensive. It was actually the initial mayday is them leaving the building, right? Yeah. And the stuff that they had employed, the volume of hose that was in the building and them getting out caused them to be him low on air and then get to the point where he needed to call a mayday.
He was on 14.
Correct.
14 came out of the building and gave a par to Rich. He had a par on everybody, and that's when he transitioned to go defensive. At that time, see, and the Tarver's captain, he, all four of them went in. So the engineer went in with them. When they left, she was the last one on the line and the first one out. The captain was the last one out, he thought. He saw her through all the smoke. And so he figured, I was the last out, you're the first out, and he just assumed that Tarver and Cy Joy were already out because that's the way we operated. When you came out of the building, it was ollie ollie umphum free. So the crew would split up. He just assumed they were going to get air or whatever else it was. So he gives a par. Well, Rich is, okay, I'm going defensive. And that's when Tarver came back and said, no, don't leave me in here. I'm lost inside. And so that's... at the time, that's when Higgins and then Nolan and everybody else is out front thinking, God damn, he's still inside the building. And they went in and got him. They found him, and he had been breathing so much smoke that he wasn't thinking clear. And so at one point, they're trying to get him out, and he basically breaks free, assaults them, leave me alone, runs back the wrong way into the back of the building, hits the floor, and he's dead right then. He died of CO poisoning when he hit the floor. 725 was leaving. Hetzel had his crew going out through the storeroom there, and he said, I'll be last one out. And he heard Tarver's pass, pre-activate, chirp. And he, okay, so Tarver was never loss for more than probably 30 seconds, right, separated from people.
Or somebody wasn't in contact.
Yeah. So whether it was his captain put him back on the line a couple times trying to get out the building. They're leaving during defensive fire conditions, and so you can't see anymore. They pulled the line in. It is clear as a bell. They're leaving 10 minutes later, and it is getting ready to go. So that piece of it is they all went back in to get him, hands on him. He frees himself, discombobulates a couple of them, and then they find 725 has hands on him immediately. And I want to say that's like the 24-minute rescue time. It took over 24 minutes to get him out of the building once they got. And he was never lost. His pass chirped and they hands on him right now. Right. So the deal that we can, he would have been the big guy grabbing you and running out with you. And they weren't going to do that with him. It was, so then you got, then the story unfolds and that's where people get faraway looks in their eyes. And
yeah, and there's multiple Maydays involved in the rescue thing.
Oh,
three
yeah.
people leave in respiratory arrest.
One Mayday caused 15 Maydays?
I think, if I remember right, it was 13, I think was the number.
Whatever it was. Yeah. They lost track because of people covering each other and things. But it was within about 3 to 5 minutes of not being able to solve the first one. And so we kind of took that out with us and thought, no, man, if you got hands on them, you can't solve it immediately. You're going to get more Maydays behind it. It's just the nature of where you're working.
And the recovery showed it, right?
Yeah.
Very clearly.
Oh,
it happened.
Yeah.
It happened to me during the recovery.
First set of drills.
Vividly. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
The difficult and confusing part of that fire was that up until then, like most of the fire service, we had done the whole series of save your own training evolutions. The ladders, the forcible entry stuff, going through walls, moving firefighters who were down. So we had been through that whole training program and all the experiences in it. When Tarver went down in that grocery store, they had to take him across the storage utility area of this store, and it was probably across this room was maybe 100 feet. They had 14 Maydays in probably 15 minutes. The firefighters who were involved in that, in trying to take him out, who ran out of air. Well, and they were at the point where the safety officers and the command system was about to call off the rescue. And actually, it was actually a body recovery. It wasn't a rescue because it took 45 minutes almost to do that. But it was kind of bewildering to our system of why it was so difficult to get him out. Now, Tarver was a huge man. He was a 260 pounds, big, tall guy, an athlete. Somebody called him Paul Bunyan. So immediately after that, in fact, the next day, we started a schedule of taking all the firefighters, actually in the automatic aid system, there was probably almost 25 fire departments, that in 3 days all toured that site. In other words, they figured out a way to describe what happened. They actually marked some of the areas that were critical to it. They put some signage up and so on. And when you went through that facility, you sort of went from, well, why didn't they get him out? Bubba and I would have got him out, to sort of reversing that and saying, I don't see how they got him out at all, because you couldn't imagine an area that was any more congested than this storage area. They had just delivered the fire occurred in the afternoon of the day of the week, whichever one it was, where they made the delivery to this grocery store. So the storage area was completely packed with food, little narrow aisles, pallets, stacks of sacks of vegetables. I mean, it looked almost like a pack rat single family residence that we've all been on, where they just loaded the thing up and they had just little narrow ways to get through the thing. They had a drop ceiling that they had used for storage above it, and we ended up the ceiling came down, So you had about a foot and a half of water and fire debris. I mean, it was just a horrible area to somehow try to operate in.
So, why was it important, Chief, to get the firefighters on location and walk in the steps that, that Tarver was rescued in?
Let's take a quick break.
Enhance fire ground leadership with our critical thinking and strategic decision-making class designed to strengthen incident command through the functions of command and foster a safer, more effective decision-making process for fire service professionals. The only critical thinking and strategic decision-making class at the Alan V. Brunicini Command Training Center in Phoenix, Arizona is May 22nd and 23rd. Sign up at bshifter.com.
There was a feeling, and let me be honest about it, that if we couldn't impress them in the reality of where they had to operate, I think that the workforce would have torn each other apart. Because they were saddened, frustrated, confused. Because, again, we had practiced taking firefighters out of fire areas under fire conditions. Completely invalid in the sense of where they had to deal with Tarver. That place outperformed any training that I think that anybody has ever done.
A lot of rumors?
Well, they were starting, even probably as the fire was burning. But, yeah, rumors, misinformation, you can imagine all the compressed time stress that everybody is under during that. So the fact that everybody got to see it, I think, was a very simple kind of thing, but I think it was a powerful thing. I know in some other fire departments have taken that same approach. I think you did recently in your system, where you had sadly had a firefighter that ended up being fatal. I think that firefighters do the best when they have information. And Chief Dickinson described the role of leaders. I think part of what you try to do is to provide that information to them, which is not complicated to say, here, go look at it. In other words, there's no mystery to it. Here's exactly what happened. A lot of the people who were actually at the event, they were players in the event. We asked them if they would take these other crews through this. They became kind of the authorities in our department in the recovery process, because they were authentically the players who were there. And these are downtown fire companies. They're busy companies. They do a lot of fire duty. I mean, they're good firefighters. They're just typical big city downtown characters. So, I mean, they don't wave a white flag at a fire. I mean, so these became the experts in what actually occurred there. And I think that was enormously therapeutic to them. In other words, that the system didn't do anything wrong, in the sense that the firefighters used the system and applied the procedures that we had developed up to that time. It's just that was a very, very sad and a very educational day to us when that situation outperformed those procedures. So it wasn't as if somebody made a mistake. It's just that we really had not developed procedures to take hose lines inside a commercial building offensively. It isn't any more complicated than that. The command team that was at that operated at that fire was I would say they were and still are probably the most capable incident commanders, big city incident commanders that do structural firefighting that I'm aware of. We supported those people in the sense that we wanted them to positively and energetically look at that event and say, what did we learn from this? And how do we change the system? Not throw the system out, but change the system and add the kinds of things that give us this offensive commercial firefighting capability from the standpoint of command. We ended up building a command training center. I had a chance probably after Tarver for a couple of years, mostly what I did was meet with firefighters in Phoenix, in the whole area. We had a study group of about 25 of us. It was about half of them were older, experienced command officers, and probably 10 or 12 of them were captains who were on the battalion chief's promotional list and would become battalion chiefs soon. We probably met 25 times for half a day. In fact, the notes that I ended up from those meetings all got mushed together in the command safety textbook that we wrote. But in that, we looked at the strategic responsibility of the incident command system to somehow protect firefighters in those kinds of situations and changed a lot of the strategic command system and management system that we used at structural fires. Now, there was an effort, too, on the tactical level to look at what is the dynamic of tactical supervision on a structural fire. And one of the things that the firefighters told us was that when we can add battalion chiefs as sector officers at a structural fire, it completely changes the dynamic of managing that fire. So soon after that fire, on a commercial event in Phoenix, we dispatched 5 battalion chiefs. And you'll hear our shift commanders say that when they get 3 companies in an operating position, they will make that a sector and put a battalion chief and their FIP, their chief's aide, and the battalion chief manages the operational part of it, and this chief's aide manages the safety. We have embedded safety in the command system in a very, very integrated, connected kind of way.
Chief, I know you made a statement to the staff about retirements. Would you recount that for us?
After the fire, soon after the fire, and I made this statement, I took some license because I said all retirements are canceled.
Why? What did you mean by that?
Well, it was no more complicated than that. Tarver was a casualty at that fire. That fire killed Brett Tarver. We did not want to have any other casualties. And there have been systems where when you lose a firefighter, you will have command staff who were involved in that fire will summarily retire. Those systems it's almost impossible for that system to recover when that occurs. Because the people who can really help that system the most are gone. Because they're the ones who were involved in it. And again, Rich Wolf is a terrific incident commander. The people who manage the command training center said that Rich Wolf is probably the best incident commander in our system, with a lot of other really capable incident commanders. We've been fussing with incident command for 35 years. So it wasn't that you had Steve Kreis was the operations chief. He was in the command post. John Hinton was a terrific incident commander. If you looked at the command team, if I was going to pick a command team, I would have picked the people who were there that day, honestly. And I'm not just saying that either. Somebody said, this is the A team. Again, we said as we were processing this, we said it was no more complicated than we had a badass fire in a badass building.
There was attempt to find a scapegoat or place blame or hanging around someone's neck. Do you want to speak to that for a
minute? No one did anything wrong. I mean, it was not really. And we've all processed fires that went wrong. I mean, now, it can't go any more wrong than losing a firefighter and almost losing 5 or 6 of them trying to get him out of the building. So no one would say in the system, well, if we had it to do over again, we'd do it the same way. I mean, that is just eminently stupid to say, particularly for a fire chief to say that. But what are we going to do about it? Now, we basically reviewed every word that we had in standard operating procedures. We enlisted every member of the Phoenix Fire Department to participate in the recovery. Anybody who had it, we processed thousands of ideas. We changed equipment. We changed procedures. We changed deployment. We built a training center for command officers and officers. We changed the dispatch process. I don't think there was any part of our system that wasn't affected by the recovery operationally. We changed the way we train. We leased commercial buildings. We went and taught ourselves that rapid intervention is not rapid and it doesn't intervene. Most of the time it exposes more firefighters. And in those days, right after the recovery, it takes 12 firefighters, 22 minutes to get a firefighter 75 feet inside the building, out of the building. And in those 12 firefighters, two of them will get in trouble. They're no different than the person that you're trying to save. I mean, they're trained the same. They're recruited the same. They're equipped the same. They operate in the same system. So there was an enormous amount of reality therapy for us after that fire. And we discovered some operational things that were habits that we had developed as an organization for years and years that led up to that. And it just took a dark and windy day for everything to come together. It was a perfect storm, I guess you could say. The way we use our resources and to not be bashful about looking at problems in that system. In other words, to make it legal for people to and acceptable and supported that people speak up if they say, we say it now is if you see something, say something. Well, that we mean that broadly too. I think we need to be more cosmopolitan. I think we're starting to be that we need to look at experiences other places and bring them back into our system and process them and say, how would we react to that? What would the effect of our resources in the system that we use be in this kind of a situation and so on? In other words, we need to be, and that's a lot of work to do that. And I think that's something that the system needs to support, on every level. One of the things we learned were that the levels, the strategic, the tactical, and the task level are connected and integrated, but they're separate. In other words, the levels can't make up for a problem that is occurring in the other level. In other words, if the command system is out of balance, all the firefighters can do, honestly, is protect themselves from that. Now, they can help command, and they can reinforce good recon and reporting and following procedures and so on. If firefighters can't lay hose and raise ladders, sending the command officers to radio school isn't going to fix it. So we sort of learned that those universes are connected closely, that there's a set of things that have to go on in those levels to make that system balance itself and be sort of totally effective. Huge issue for us was tactical supervision, is that we really had never spent much time or energy in looking at sectors, divisions, groups. In other words, management subdivisions in that process that are both functional and geographic, all the standard ICS stuff, is that we really had not invested much in that level. And it's been interesting to see the effect of that. Completely different outcomes. When you watch those events, they're smoother. The stress level is down. You'll hear incident commanders say, like shift commanders say, once we get sectors in place, you can go to sleep in the command post almost. So they call it low stress command, and some of it, we talked about it earlier, is it's just as simple as saying, and I hear it all the time, so I'll repeat it. They say, we get three companies in a position, we put a sector officer in. Chief and an aide, they do operations, they do safety, they do an integrated. If there's enough activity that's going to go on for long, we actually make a safety section. We think that safety is critical enough that it's actually a section responsibility. It's a little bit different. We add it to the regular section process in ICS. So it's been interesting to sort of see that. But no, I think we just need to be more critical of ourselves. And I mean that in a constructive way. I don't mean it in a mean-spirited way at all.
With the discussion about Brett Tarver's father-in-law, I think most folks would cringe at the idea of interacting with someone that the perception would be there was so much harm, not out of fear of retribution, but would feel very uncomfortable. How did that go at first? What would have caused you, I'm thinking out loud here, to get out of the box, to open up that relationship, which has probably allowed a lot more of the healing to go on? you know, it would have been the natural tendency to avoid him instead of to embrace him, I think.
Tarver's wife was a very analytic woman. She was a mathematician and a computer correction specialist. So she was a very technically trained and capable person. She said very early in this, she said, quit moping around and figure out what you're going to do to keep this from happening again. And my response to her was, yes, ma'am. And I think that as we showed her that we were doing that, she connected to that. Her father was a very warm, smart, responsive guy. He was able, I think, even more than she was, to connect to the emotional part of the event. She was pretty analytic. So it was interesting between the two of them. They actually helped us a lot in the sense that she was very businesslike about saying, your role now is to keep this from happening. She said, we're obviously all heartbroken because it did. I mean, not to say that she wasn't affected by it at all. She was. He was again a lot more emotionally connected to it. So it was kind of an interesting combination. I mean, which was unusual, Dennis, when you sort of when I think back on it. But
once that door was opened, they ended up being more supportive, is what I'm hearing you saying.
Yeah, they were,
and they helped resolve more of the problems and issues than what they cost.
And I told the staff, I mean, I'm not remarkable. I says, take yes for an answer. In other words, and we reported to her pretty intensely for 3 or 4 years about the recovery. She honestly probably got sick of the recovery because she got to see a lot of standard operating procedures that probably didn't mean a whole lot to her. And we connected her as much as we could, which was a lot, with the planning and the changes that we made as we evolved in that recovery. So, and I think that even though she probably OD'd on some of the details that we did, that probably didn't, again, I don't mean it critically, she's just not a firefighter, probably didn't make much sense to her. I think that she saw that we were serious about keeping it from happening again. And it changed the recovery changed the way that we operated tactically almost across the board. Because we figured out unremarkably that what we did every day developed a set of habits that we took into major events. So if we were going to fix it, in other words, if we were running out of air at house fires, we were going to run out of air at a commercial building. So the place that we were going to fix it was at house fires. So it became a pretty energetic kind of a process to say, let's go back and clean up the 10% that got us in trouble. And I think that's probably what it was. 90% of the system was sound, well done, well established procedures and habits and practices and just the way that we operated. But there were some things that we needed to change, and we did. But it's a high risk business for a boss. You're using resources to go in and intervene in problems that are underway. In other words, that supermarket was burning. And again, we have an obligation to go perform what we do at those places. And again, you try to do it in a sensible, safe, standard kind of way. But it's an interesting business when you look at it.
Chief, I can't. That's just starting to experience this event. You know, unfortunately, it seems like we'll kill about 100 firefighters every year, and that number tends, I guess, to have stabilized or go up very slightly. But nonetheless, there'll be others behind you, Chief, that'll have this unfortunate, horrible, unbelievable, unmanageable experience. What advice would you leave them with? What would you tell them that'll get them through the day?
Well, I think our service has a pretty natural inclination to do rehab, and that's a good thing. I think, though, it needs to be balanced with prehab. and I've heard Chief Dickinson say it, is that, you're not going to come out of that event. When you lose it, let me talk about losing a firefighter, is you're not going to come out of that with any more than you go into it with. So if you want to know what's going to go on in an organization 2 weeks after a sad event, look at what was going on 2 weeks before. And I think if you looked at, and certainly we had problems and always will in Phoenix, I mean, but it was a terrific organization, a great city, and we had healthy relationships in the system. I think the people cared about each other. We were open to new things and had been, I think, for a long time. I don't think that there were big issues of trust or relationship problems or so on. We had a good relationship with the union. And I think that's really what got us through. In other words, that we used the systems that were in place. We used basically the relationship by objective system that we had with our union. And the recovery, the recovery was managed within the labor management process. Well, that's a pretty tough time to start a relationship with the union if you haven't. I mean, so we had 25 years of developing that process. Now, I wish that the process could have been more proactive to look at the habits that you were doing every day and say, which habits are we engaging in routinely that are going to get us in trouble if we don't fix them? I think that caused us, that experience, that Brett Tarver experience, caused us to be a lot more sensitive or responsive to that kind of a surveillance system. In other words, that awareness in the department that it was a lot more acceptable and understandable to say, you know, this is screwy. This doesn't make sense. We've been lucky. And when the holes in the Swiss cheese all line up, somebody's either going to get really beat up or they're going to get killed. I think use the system when that occurs. Charlie talked about delegation. I think you're overwhelmed with all the people, places, and things that are coming together when that occurs. So if you don't have sort of the habit and the set of experiences where you can delegate very quickly, I think that's certainly going to be a tough time for you. I think it was interesting to me because we had lost, sadly, firefighters before Tarver. It was never the community response that produced. Is his death in Phoenix disrupted the community for a week or 10 days. I mean, big city that has a lot of news going on every day in it. I mean, it's a really active, energetic place. So there is a lot of news, if you may, and news displaces itself. During the funeral festival that you end up with in that, it kind of shut down the city. It was really kind of impressive. And people who study it in the community said that it was the relationship that the firefighters had developed with the people in the community, one call at a time. I honestly wasn't surprised, I guess, but it was really an interesting experience. So there, I think, let the community act out the way they feel. Tarver had a beautiful family, had a beautiful wife and three little girls, just gorgeous little girls, and obviously the community embraced them like they do.
That was 23 years ago, right? And there's probably this week, there's going to be a whole lot of firefighters in Phoenix that will remember where they were and exactly what they did that day, because we had a lot of firefighters that I'm going in. I got a quarter air in my bottle. I don't care. I'm going in anyway. You got an incident commander who's really focusing on the hazard zone, trying to make it all come together. You got what we didn't have. You had an IC with a plan. You didn't have sufficient information to know that structure until it was too late, that the smoke was coming down on top of them. When you charge the lines make a lot of movement in there, knock everything off the shelf. Now it's dark. It's not the same as when you went in. You got firefighters after the May Day that said, I'm the guy that's going to get them out. My crew's going to go get them out. Let's go. We get 13 May Days from that. What we didn't have is and Nick likes to talk about it because it makes the most sense to me afterwards, is one of the biggest changes we made, is we didn't have tactical bosses effectively operating in that fire ground. We just didn't do a very good job with that.
No. Well, and Chris said it. Chris went there later on to relieve Engine 6. Rich Wolf made Engine 6. He assigned them to set up a treatment sector on that south entrance in preparation of Tarver coming out. The next time he heard from Engine 6, it was a mayday that they needed help getting out of the building. You're getting ready to get Tarver out, and then all of a sudden your treatment crew is maydaying you that they need help getting out of the building. And that was like, that discombobulated them. They thought, they're just freelancing. But that's to your point, there's no tactical bosses. If there was a tactical boss at Engine 6 comes over, they're like, no. Treatment sector does not wear an SCBA mask. So there would be a tactical level supervisor. And until there was, you guys got shit in the command post as far as information.
And it just happened by default, ultimately. But
exactly.
Right? It's really important, from my position at least, that we talk about this and we remind people the things and stories and why this incident's so important to us and why it's so important to Blue Card now.
Just think about it. Now we talk about the recovery 23 years later. The recovery took how many years, Nick?
We were doing it when he retired in 2006.
Yeah, it was 5 years.
It was 5 years. He says it's never done. It was his deal. And
you talk about a recovery like it's a word that's been in the dictionary forever. But he applied that recovery process to Phoenix for the first time I think it had ever been done like that. And it changed our entire organization. Everything, every conversation we had, and pretty much everything we did focused on how can we improve and not let this happen again.
All's well that ends well, man. We're all here talking about it today. In fact, Vance said it. He had more effect leaving than he had staying when it was all said and done.
How many fire departments, Blue Card?
Over 3,000. I mean, it was – there's more that – I mean, shit, fire command was the law of the land for – they determined about 85% of it. I mean, it was the only thing out there, so.
Well, and at the time, too, the media was fire engineering, fire rescue, firehouse. Mm-hmm. And I think there was a Brunicini article in all three of those, or a Phoenix Fire article, Steve Christ. I mean, you were writing, Terry. Yeah. Were you writing at all at that? But
I learned to write after that.
Well, Fire Rescue Magazine was the Phoenix Fire Department Journal. There was like six people writing. Yeah.
They were stealing our stuff and writing a Mercury and
And you guys were writing about about the recovery process at the time. Though,
we about so much more than that, Vance.
We were learning in real time. The fire service was learning in real time what was going on. Yeah, you didn't have to go to a conference. Blue Card wasn't around, but we were reading it every month in those magazines.
Yeah. Well, then when we started doing Blue Card, probably about 2008. I mean, that was who you were. You were going into places, and it was the safety officers and rapid intervention instructors. You'd argue with them for 2 days, and then by the third day, everybody else would agree with you, and they would go do something else, and you'd do Blue Card for a couple more days and then go.
All right, guys. Great conversation today. I think it was a great way to remember Brett Tarver 23 years later. We continue to educate people on what happened that day. And I think it's continuing to have a very serious impact on the American Fire Service, because today, as we go to class here at the ABBCTC, we're talking about the Tarver recovery process.
Thursday, on the anniversary.
Yep. And which is why we're getting together to talk about it today. So thanks for sharing. And thanks, everyone, for watching this B-Shifter.